Why did Matt Barnes chase John Henson into the locker room? Is Jahlil Okafor following down the same path as Barnes? Did Byron Scott's coaching methods end up working with D'Angelo Russell? The only question left is, say it with me, you win. Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to the B-Ball Breakdown Podcast. I sincerely hope you're listening to this on our brand new mobile app because it sounds so much better and smarter there. Today, I'm pleased to bring on the show Scott Howard Cooper, who is an NBA.com national writer and NBA TV contributor and a guy that I harass at Summer League whenever we run into each other. So, Scott, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's a good kind of harassing. It's always good to talk with you.
I appreciate it. Let's see what we can figure out and whose problems that we can solve today. Last night, Matt Barnes had another interesting run-in with security or whoever you want to call it. I don't know if you saw too much of it, but John Henson blocked his shot toward the end of the game. And it appeared that he, I guess, was talking a little trash. And that I guess that's enough to set Matt Barnes off and get him charging into the tunnel?
Well, I think that anybody who has followed the league certainly knows Matt's history, and we know that it doesn't take a lot to get him in a bad place. This has been something that he's been needing to work on, I think most people would agree, for quite some time. I know that Matt in some way sees it as a positive, that one of the reasons he has been in the league this long when he was not a high draft pick is because of his passion, because of exactly this kind of energy and emotion. This is what he brings to a team, and this is why he continues to be wanted. This is why a lot of clubs like him on their roster, because he cares. He cares deeply. It's just sometimes it goes too far.
Well, it's funny because I feel like that caring and that passion isn't the same as 5 minutes after something happens, like charging into the tunnel to try and fight someone who blocked your shot. And I'm still trying to dig it down deeper to find out if anything had happened earlier in the game, because the game had been decided by that point. It was a 10-point game, 5 seconds to go. And I think that's, I suppose, why they decided to just eject Henson and get him out of there so it wouldn't rile him up, although that seemed to backfire as well.
You make a good point that there's a difference between something that happens on the court, maybe he reacted to a specific incident, but then when there's that delay and it's something that continues off the court, again, I'm not excusing him. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this is who he is and what he does, and unfortunately, I don't think many people are terribly surprised, but it's something that needs to be dealt with, and I think Matt probably would be the first guy to say that.
Are you based in Sacramento? Am I correct in saying that?
Yes.
So it's safe to say you probably, you know, you've been around, you know, sort of that area for a long time and you know, have a good sense of what's happening maybe with the Warriors and the Kings. Is that fair?
I would like to think so.
Okay. Because I'm kind of curious, when you look at a guy like Matt Barnes and what his history is and how he uses that emotion, well, you know, you don't have to go very far to find another player on the Warriors that has that similar thing in Draymond Green. And I'm curious, from your perspective being in that area, if you see parallels or is that way off?
I think it's way off. There's a difference between a guy that shows a lot of emotion on the court, somebody that will have no problem getting physical with you on the court, things like that. That's Draymond. That's Andrew Bogut as well, by the way. Uh-huh. That's a couple guys on the Warriors who are going to be very in your face and very confrontational. But there's a big, big difference between that and having issues that carry off the court.
Fair enough. Okay, and I agree. I think, you know, because we saw a little bit of that with Draymond during halftime of the game against, I want to say OKC. I think he had a little bit of a freak out. but that, okay, and that seems to me, I can recognize the difference there where, right, I guess when it starts to bleed in the off-court stuff, it almost feels like the NFL versus the NBA. Is that fair?
Yeah, well, and again, Draymond's so-called freak out was something where he was shouting at halftime within the locker room. It wasn't going up the tunnel after something. It wasn't getting involved in a fight with somebody who at the time was a coach for another team, completely off the court. And again, it's not like this is a, you know, wow, Matt Barnes, I never would have expected that. there has been a series of incidents. So no, I think it's completely different than the emotions of getting caught up in when you're frustrated during a game and you're in your locker room. It's not like you got in a fist fight with anybody. There was some shouting, and I think that those things happen a lot more than people realize. And I'll say this as well, since we're on the topic of Matt. I've known him for many years, since before he was in the NBA. And there's a lot of positives about him. This is a guy that has made a career when he was a long shot just to stick in the NBA as a rookie. He constantly cut, not being re-signed at the end of a contract, going through the D-League. This is a guy that's really, he has a lot to be proud of. And the emotions are obviously the thing that he's going to be most remembered for, which is unfortunate. It's also his own doing, but it is unfortunate because there's a lot of positives about the guy. I enjoy being around him. I think he's very smart. I think he cares a great deal about the game and about winning. So nobody can disagree with anything that when somebody criticizes his ability to handle his emotions. But if we're going to, I don't want to get too far down the road without also saying that there's a lot of positives about this guy as well.
I'm glad that we can get that on the record, because for sure, you know, it's funny. I have mined a 6 second clip last, you know, during the playoffs where after a win, 10 kids, all ages, you know, from like 6 to 12, whatever, he's come rushing up to him in the tunnel to give him a big hug. And it was very heartwarming in a sense that you could just see what you're talking about there. He's got these two sides. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me is that oftentimes, like with Draymond, it's a spur of the moment, you know, passionate, you know, explosion of emotion. Whereas, you know, for instance, with Matt, when he got into his confrontation with Derek Fisher, like there was driving involved. I don't think it wasn't from, you know, what they originally said, but he had a 10-minute drive, right? And that's the kind of stuff that makes me wonder, because there's a cooling off period there where at some point you'd be like, you know, this is not going to be such a big thing, and yet he manages to keep the fuel going, you know, longer than most.
No, it's a problem. And again, I think the unfortunate thing is for a guy that you would think one day when he's long into retirement and looking back and people are talking about him, there should be so many positives. And I think there still will be at some level. But the first thing that people are going to say is Matt and his wacky moments. And that's on him. It's unfortunate, but it's on him because he's the one that's not handling this.
Absolutely. Well, you know, let's move on to a couple other ideas here, because, you know, and it's interesting. We've seen a little bit of off-court stuff, you know, with Jahlil Okafor even. And it's funny because most of the time we have a very short memory, I imagine, where he gets into a little thing and then it's over. I have to imagine from what I've seen in the way he plays and what I've heard that here's a guy who's just made a very small, minor blip mistake. He's actually like a great kid, a great teammate. And that's my impression of it. Would that be accurate?
I think that the reason you give a guy like Jahlil Okafor a little bit more slack is because he's a rookie. He's a guy that would be a college sophomore right now had he stayed in school. So again, I think it's a much different thing than it is with Matt. I don't want to try to equate those situations. There is enough there to be concerned, and obviously the 76ers were concerned enough because they suspended him. That between where he has been late at night after games, how fast he has been driving on city streets in and around Philadelphia, that's not good. There's no excuse. There's no reason for anybody to soft pedal that and to say anything other than he's got to be making better decisions than that. But again, young guy, and you hope that he gets in a situation and the 76ers bring in the right people, not just the right players, but the right people to put in that locker room to say, no, this is how it's done, not that way. So you want to give him the benefit of the doubt because he's young and everybody makes mistakes, and everybody especially makes mistakes in their youth.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to bury him too much, but yes, it's something he needs to prove is just bad moments of youth and not something that's going to be a pattern that's going to continue for throughout his career.
Yeah, I mean, I thank my lucky stars every day that there were no cell phone cameras when I was 19 years old.
How about
college.
That? You know, how different would all of our lives be if a lot of things that we did at college age were able to be put out to the world within 2 minutes after it happened?
I know. It's crazy. And it's actually a good lesson, too. I think the 10-year-olds and 11-year-olds coming up now, you know, unfortunately for them, it's another level of another thing they have to then sort of worry about. It makes life more complicated than it might have been in the past. But, you know, I don't want to overshadow what he's doing on the court because, you know, this rookie of the year race feels like it's turned into a two-man race. And between him and Towns, and you know, what are your feelings on you know who's playing better and who might win that award? And by the way, is it even about numbers, or is it some sort of narrative that forms and then takes over?
Oh, I think it tends to be about numbers, especially the scoring numbers. The voters love kind of the glitzy things. I thought that Nerlens Noel last year had a really good case for Rookie of the Year, and the voters as a whole disagreed with me resoundingly because Wiggins not only won, but he won in a landslide. So people love the score numbers, and that's not to put down Andrew, but I'm just saying that Nerlens Noel is a guy that finished in the top 10 in the league, not just among rookies, top 10 in the league in two different categories. I thought he had an impressive season and a really good to be made, and he got left in the dust by Andrew Wiggins. So I think it showed, again, that people love the scoring numbers, and if you can put up the big rebounding numbers as well, that's helped. That's really the big thing about Towns is he excelled at almost every facet of the game. Offensively, he scored so many different places. Defensively, he made an impact, and that's a good chance to finish in the top 10 of the league in blocks, as well as his scoring numbers, when you look at especially the second half of the season, have really been off the charts. The thinking at the start of the year was with Andrew Wiggins, and suddenly we look, and he's getting around the All-Star break and after the All-Star break, he's getting more shots than Andrew Wiggins. So it's more like it's not about him fitting in anymore. It's about him taking control. So I think that I think that Tam should win easily. I think he deserves it. He's been terrific from the start. You would have a lot of trouble finding a time where he had a bad, say, 2 weeks in a row. He's just been so consistent. He's been so good. The transition has gone smoother than I think probably anybody, I don't know about him, but most anybody around the league would have expected. After that, Porzingis has been good. He's often been very good defensively and rebounding. The offense has been inconsistent. I had Jahlil Okafor third pretty much all season, and now I dropped him for two different reasons. One, it's gotten to the point where he's missed so much time. He's into his third week of missing games. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have dropped somebody after 1 week if they have a sprained ankle, for example, that costs them three or four games. But now it's gotten so long. And number two, the people behind him have been playing really well. So it's not just that he was slipping by not being on the court, but a lot of other people were gaining as well. Guys like Nikola Jokic, D'Angelo Russell, Justice Winslow are all having good finishes.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, as an aside about Nerlens Noel, I was kind of hoping he'd win it too, because before that year started, I had been adamant that because he had a year of just training with NBA professionals rather than being in college while he was rehabbing and whatever, he'd just be light years ahead of any other rookie that year. And so I kind of wanted to be proven right on that one. And you're right, it's interesting to see, because I guess the real question here, before we get back into the specific players, is that, you know, do you vote for Rookie of the Year? Are you one of the people?
No, I don't have any votes and I don't want one.
Okay. Because that's the other thing is, you know, all I do all day is watch footage. And yet, like, I haven't seen Porzingis play in a month. And so there's no way that people have a chance to really have time to, you know, have enough, you know, to really watch this stuff, right? So they have to rely on other means. And that's what it's interesting to me, because, you know, maybe that's what gets Wiggins the award. It's sort of, that's what it gets, the whatever gets stirred up and everyone starts to believe it because they're not looking at it. And no fault of theirs. There's just no time. You know what I mean?
You can only watch so many games a day. I know that there's some people out there that will DVR or go back on the computer the next day and watch a couple games or parts of several games that they maybe wanted to see. But I think that the majority of the media people who vote don't do that. Where I think that people can make up the difference if by not simply relying on their own eye test, since, as you said, there's no way everybody can see everything. Even you know that, and you're the guy that breaks down everything.
Yeah.
is you have to talk to the people in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Back, I still do this a lot now because I do the rookie ranking, so I want the input. But when I was voting, as it got to the season, you just take 3 seconds with a player in the locker room, or an assistant coach, a head coach, a scout who does the NBA games, head coach, assistant coach, executive. Hey, you know, I'm a little bit torn on, give me your thoughts on coach of the year. Give me some feedback on rookie of the year. If I were to give you two or three names, you tell me how you rank them. And you get that viewpoint. Because I think that that's critical. You go to the people who know the game the best. You don't simply rely on the stats.
That's a great point, too. So, yeah, and that's, you're right. There's certainly a real value, because those are the guys you're talking to, coaches who, you know and are also watching. So, you know, there's also been this interesting meme about sort of Porzingis kind of falling off, right? He was, I thought, you know, certainly for the first 2 or 3 months, he was in that conversation with Towns to be Rookie of the Year. I'm kind of peeping at his stats, though, and they don't look like they've fallen off that much. So what are you hearing out of New York and what's going on with him?
Well, offensively, it has been a struggle for him, especially lately. And right now, I think the thing is for him to get back in a good direction. It's obviously a team-wide thing as well, because there was a time that the Knicks as a whole had reason to be really encouraged about the entire season, and they've fallen off the map. And Chris is part of that as well. Because it's been a problem now for several weeks. His shot has gone really bad, and now he's been sick. So it's been a really tough time. They need him to get healthy. They need him to have that big finish. And I think it's certainly something that's possible. It's no fun to be sick. It just drains you. It's not just the games that you missed. I saw him the other night in Oakland when the Knicks played the Warriors. And it was clear that he was struggling just physically. Wasn't a lot of shots going front rim. He rebounded pretty well, as I recall, but his shot clearly was a problem. So he needs to get healthy. He's a guy that's a nonstop worker. He's put in so much time early on that the Knicks finally had to tell him, knock it off.
Okay.
It's great that you're showing up early and staying late. And like a lot of guys do, they'll come back. Sometimes they'll do a workout, or if the team has an off day, they'll come into the gym late at night to get up some shots. But there's also a point where it's too much, that you say you it's a long season. You still want to make sure that you are fresh for the games. Don't work out like it's summertime and that you can go several hours just in the workouts before you even get into a summer league game or you get into a pickup game. The priority is still to be your best in the games. And I think that for a while they were worried that Chris was putting in too much work, and mm-hmm. that they didn't want him to sort of run himself into the ground in January or February. So they said, dial it back a little bit.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really important, especially, you know, even if you're 19 or whatever, you know, when you're that young, it doesn't feel like that can happen, but it's crazy what this game can do to anybody and how tired it can make you. Let me get this straight, because I've talked to a lot of people in Latvia. We have a huge Latvian audience. They were telling me that the correct pronunciation is Porzingis. And I want to be correct, but have you talked to him? Have you asked him, do we know how you're supposed to say that name if you were in Latvia?
I had not heard that before. No, I haven't asked him, but my next opportunity I definitely will. I'm glad that they pointed that out. I can certainly, I don't have to say his name as much as I type his name. But, if that's the proper pronunciation, then that's what we'll do.
All right.
I've talked to him several times, and he's never made any reference to that at all.
All right, well, let's get to the bottom of that, because, you know, I like to, you know, pronounce him the correct way, like, you know, Marcelo Huertas. I like to do a little bit of the pronunciation like they do. So I want to get Porzingis right if I can. If you want to help, that would be awesome. and then speaking of the Knicks and how that's going, you know, what do you make of this notion of Phil coaching home games only? And if that is that actually a real thing, or is that just somebody who overheard something that wasn't, you know, third person and not even verified?
Yeah, I would say unless that came from Phil, or yeah, unless that came from somebody on the coaching staff, like if Kurt Rambis had said, one of the things that Phil and I had talked about is me coming back as associate head coach and him doing the home games. If it's something that's that sounds much more, I don't want to say definitive, much more official. Who knows? Maybe the leak came from Phil himself. You never know on things like that. I would say, knowing him, it's a little bit doubtful. He never hesitates to put his name behind anything. Mm-hmm. It sounds, not only does it sound unlikely, it sounds unrealistic. And I think that Phil would be the first to say that. I know that that's something that he had considered as far back as when he was coaching with the Lakers, and the physical woes were starting to pile up. And his feeling was, I still have the desire to do this. I think mentally I'm still into it, but physically it takes that much more out of you, getting on the planes, going to the different hotel rooms. It's a lot of late nights. It's luxurious living. I'm not saying that they travel like you and I and most of the rest of the world. They have a bus that drives them out to the plane. They have to walk up the steps. Somebody takes care of the luggage. They're staying at very, very nice places, so it's not like he's schlepping his bag all over. But when you've had that many problems with your knees and your hips, mm-hmm, you just don't want that extra wear and tear. Really makes a difference. But I think that Phil would be the first to say, because he said it in the past, that something like that just doesn't work. You have to have a coach. You can't have, all right, here's who's coaching tonight because we're at Madison Square Garden, and here's who's going to be coaching tomorrow when you're at Boston or Washington,
yeah,
or Miami or something like that. I don't think it's likely.
Right. It certainly would be weird from dynamic of however you want to look at it. Even if Phil and Rambis are on the, you know, the exact same page and they're talking all the time, it just would be, you know, I mean, the Cubs tried that with their college of coaches. I think I just aged myself. I don't know if you remember. You probably remember that too, right?
I'm sorry. Who did
the Cubs, the Chicago Cubs in like 1960 something, did a college of coaches. They had, you know, five or six different managers.
I did not know. I figured they were just turning them over because they suck.
Yeah, well, that was probably the compromise. It didn't work at all. I grew up down the street from Wrigley Field, so I suppose it stuck in my brain. The Cubs' history is stuck in my brain. But, I just can't imagine that working very well. So I'm glad that doesn't seem very realistic at all. But, you know, the thing that you mentioned about Towns, before we get to a couple other things, is – does he really have a position? I don't know. We can't consider him a center, can we?
I think a little more center than power forward, but as you know, these days, things like titles of positions are much more blurred than they used to be. There's plenty of guys that maybe a few years ago you would say, this guy's definitely a power forward. Mm-hmm. Now it's, he'll play center, play some power forward. It's not that big a deal. I tend to often come back to the old line of, you are who you guard. So if you're defending centers, you're a center.
I like that.
Different things like that. But again, not a big deal. I think the important thing is, I don't care what title you want to give the guy for his position, it's can he play. And you can put him at power forward. You can put him at center, probably depending on the matchups. But he's going to succeed at either spot. He's clearly going to be the best player out of this draft.
Yeah, and by the way, this draft is pretty darn good, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think it's good. My sense of what I had coming into the season is projecting to hold true. We won't have I'm one of those guys that believes you don't make any big judgments off a rookie season. You give it 3 or 4 or 5 years, and you take the entire body of work to get a real read on the careers. But I think that what you're going to see is people will look back at the end of it, if you look up in 10 years when most careers are over, and they're going to say that was a good draft. I don't think it'll be a great draft. I don't think you're going to see a ton of guys that'll be all-stars 5 times, for example, or a lot of guys going into the Hall of Fame. But I think you're going to have a lot of guys out of this draft who will have long, solid, successful careers that will be key players on good teams. I think that there's not going to be a lot of great, but I think there will be a lot of solid, and I think people are going to look back and say, yeah, that was a good draft.
Yeah, I mean, and then, you know, the number 2 pick, D'Angelo Russell, is finally kind of locked in there a little bit. Have you had a chance to watch a lot of what he's doing?
I have. Struggled a lot at the beginning, struggled with his shot, really struggled with the ball handling, the turnovers, but has really, really been playing well now since about midpoint of the season, maybe a little bit earlier. I don't remember the exact time on the calendar when it seemed to click. But the Lakers have a lot of reason to be encouraged by what they've seen. And really, it's a statement that there was a lot of talk at the time, as I'm sure you remember, about, oh, my God, the Lakers are crazy. How do you can't take D'Angelo Russell. You have to take Jahlil Okafor. And I think that there was a case. And, in fact, I wrote this a few weeks before the draft and got shouted down all over the Internet that there's a strong, realistic case, that there's solid reasons for the Lakers to take D'Angelo Russell. And I think this is what you're seeing. This is exactly why it made sense. He's got the ability to be a guy that's going to hit shots with a lot of range and become a very good passer. You can't say he's been the best rookie the second half of the season, because that's still Karl Anthony Towns, who's been the best from the beginning and continues to be the best. But D'Angelo Russell is really, really going well.
Absolutely. You know, we had seen glimpses, and obviously it was frustrating because with the dynamic between him and Byron Scott, and, you know, it's hard to judge too much, because when you hear from reports on the sideline, it's always sort of one-sided. You never really know the actual, you know, realistic part of it. But what you did hear a little bit was the frustration of Russell, that, you know, he doesn't know what Byron Scott expects from him. And knowing what we know about Byron Scott, it doesn't sound unreasonable to assume that he would take the old school approach, which was, I'm not going to spoon feed him information. He's going to have to learn it on his own and struggle, yada, yada. You know, and that's sort of, I guess, can we even, if that's the case, can we fault Byron Scott, because it seems to have eventually worked?
Fault Byron Scott on this or in
on the way he's treating, well, let's move on to that one next, but like, yeah, the way he's treating Russell.
Probably not, because even when D'Angelo was not starting, he was still getting the minutes. It's not like he said, I understand it was an ego blow for D'Angelo, and it felt bad and it looked bad to say, I'm taking you out of the starting lineup. That's all completely understandable. But it's not like Byron said, I'm taking you out of the starting lineup and I'm playing you 12 minutes a game. He was still getting a lot of minutes. He was getting fourth quarter minutes. Two different schools of thoughts on this, and there's cases to be made for both. And you tell me what you think makes more sense. Case one, you're one of the foundations of the future for this team. You and Julius Randle and Jordan Clarkson are who we're building on moving forward. Here's 32 minutes a game every night, no matter what, because the experience will be valuable for you down the line, and we right now are playing for down the line, not to win a championship this year. Okay, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Point two, you got to earn it. You can't just have things given to you. And you know how I know this? Kobe Bryant told me. We had a conversation earlier in the season because he went through something similar where when he was coming off the bench as a rookie, and Kobe, as you might imagine, was just a little bit on the competitive side.
Yeah.
and even then, and so he was not taking it well, and he would do a slow burn, and he was shooting Del Harris the dagger eyes, and Kobe was furious. He was beside himself. He couldn't believe that he wasn't starting and getting 48 minutes a night. And so now you look up and it's the end of his career, and what's Kobe saying? That was one of the best things that could have happened to him. Nothing was handed to him. He had to earn everything. He hated it at the time, but he's the first guy now to say, you don't want things handed to you. You have to earn it. So that's the second school of thought, and that's something that everybody who was screaming at Byron, all the Laker fans, and that's something that D'Angelo, with his frustration, I think would do well to keep in mind, that no less an expert than Kobe Bryant says you should have to earn it. You don't want to have it handed to you.
You know what? I agree, and that is fantastic. And I don't think I even connected the whole Kobe thing when he was coming up. Let's not forget that he was behind, I believe, Eddie Jones.
Right.
Who was fantastic at the time. Like, he would never have taken those minutes from him anyway. But, of course, you know, and I'm sure in the young Kobe's mind he was better, and he ultimately was. But that is true. I love it. I think the only issue here, and then we can talk a little bit about, like, the coaching stuff with a couple of these coaches, is in today's NBA, and even back in Kobe, I think that there needs to be, you have to earn your minutes. We're going to, you know, make you work for them. But why not, like, spend the time to go through it and explain and talk about what's the issues, what you're doing wrong, what you're doing right, you know, in a constructive way rather than what it's. And again, it sounded like this from that report from Aldridge, you know, during the game, that he just was sort of like, you know, not saying anything. And that, I think, is the issue. Whether or not it's effective or not, I just feel like in today's day and age, and whether you agree with it, it is what it is. You need to provide explanation, maybe over-explanation, to players who are younger today if you want to keep keep them in a positive frame of mind.
You're right. There's no question about that. Communication is very, very important, not just with a coach talking to a rookie as the rookie tries to find his way, but as the coach with everybody, whether it's D'Angelo Russell or it's Byron's, Kobe Bryant. I mean, that's been around a million years. There's no question about that. But I think that Byron has made it pretty clear that he has communicated and he has told D'Angelo what's expected. If D'Angelo is frustrated, maybe he's either misunderstanding, because can you really believe that Byron Scott is going to go a whole year and not say, here's what I need you to do better, do more of this, do less of that, that Byron Scott's really, this is Byron's dream job. It's coaching his former team in his hometown. You think that if, and certainly the management, if they saw a problem, they would go to Byron and say, you need to just do a better job of explaining to D'Angelo, to Jordan Clarkson, to Julius Randle, to the young guys, what they need to do better. Don't you think that he would? I think that Byron has made it clear that he feels like he has communicated. And that's an interesting thing. I would also say that if D'Angelo Russell, this is a man's league, and if you feel like you're not understanding something, if you feel like you are, Byron, I can't figure out what I'm missing here. Tell me what I'm doing wrong. What do I need to do better? Mm-hmm. Tell me specifically what you want to see. D'Angelo should go to him. If he has any misunderstanding, if he feels like there's a communication problem, don't just sit there and say, well, this is on Byron. He's got to do a better job of talking with me. You go to him. If you think that you're not getting the message, if you feel like there's a communications breakdown, it's obviously on the coach first of all, but it's on the player as well at some point.
I agree. You're right. And that's the other thing. Like, you know, I'm doing some armchair quarterbacking here, which is not fair at all. But hey, it's my show. So
we're good at that.
Yeah. You know, because here's my take on, and it's probably somewhat warm to hot as far as the take goes. You know, the coaches from that era, we have guys like Sam Mitchell, Byron Scott, even like Scott Skiles, former players. I don't know if you saw, there's an interview with Sam Mitchell that was pretty, you know, candid a couple months ago in a Minnesota, you know, website. And there just seems to be a sense of sort of frustration based on what his own personal experience was and how it's not the same now. Like, I knew all these fundamentals when I came into the league. These young kids don't know that, and they're frustrated. Whereas the other way to look at it would be like, oh, Russell, D'Angelo, you don't know about you know, how to pivot out of a pick and roll. This is great. I'm going to teach it to you. We're going to show you. This is like watching Willy Wonka for the first time, and I get to watch it with you. Like that in my mind, if that creeps in, and certainly with Sam Mitchell, it feels like it is, that's when the players tend to tune out or mishear what you're trying to say because you're kind of frustrated that it wasn't like how it was when you came in, as opposed to, you know, being excited about it because you get to teach it to them. And again, hot take, total whatever, but do you have any feeling for that kind of, you know, idea?
Hey, you kids, get off of my lawn.
Right.
And by the way, bonus points to you if I could have predicted the conversation would go a million different ways today. I don't think I saw a Willy Wonka poll coming.
You know, I have no idea why that I've said that a couple of times. I hope not on the show before, but certainly with, you know, people, coaches. I have no idea.
It's not a bad one.
By the way, the original Willy Wonka, not this like Johnny Depp thing. I'm talking about Gene Wilder original.
Thank you. I'm glad that's the important point, I think, that people should take out of this entire podcast. is that the original Willy Wonka is much better, except for the dancing scene. I hope we can agree on that. When Mrs. Bucket is doing the laundry and gets into the song and dance, I thought that's when it went off the rails. And at last, we get to the real gist of what this interview will be about. But
yes.
As far as that side thing about basketball that will work into the conversation, I think that there's a difference between being from that era, being old school, and being a good communicator, because you can't go around and say these kids today. You have to, if you want to be an NBA coach, assistant or head coach, you have to be able to adjust to the times. And that's, you can't go around saying, Byron can't say, well, this is how Magic did it. This is how Worthy did it. This is what Kareem and Cooper did. That's just not going to fly. But at the same time, I would say there's nothing wrong with having some old school ideals as long as you have the right team. Is there anybody, I was about to say in the NBA coaching circle, but maybe in the entire world, is there anybody that's more old school than Greg Popovich?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, here's the thing.
Shut up and play. Show up on time. No complaining. Don't worry about the endorsements. Just shut up and play. But he doesn't come across as old school because he deals with people. He is a exceptional talent at dealing with the personalities and working with people, not just the X's and O's aspect. So there's nothing wrong with being old school and understanding that the original Willy Wonka is better, but it's how you deal with people. And you can be from that era of Byron Scott and Sam Mitchell and still deal with people of 2016 in the right way. I don't think that's any different than saying maybe there's a young coach coming up. We've all seen this. Somebody will be in their first head coaching job. They'll be relatively young, and it's the modern day, and they have trouble relating to people. And then it's because you say, well, you don't have the proper experience. On the second job, they'll be a lot better at handling situation X because they'll have gone through it before. So I don't think it's about the date on the birth certificate. I think it's really about the personality and the makeup of the person.
I agree. And you know the funny thing about Popovich is that I think he kind of looks the part and he does it to the media, but he has a very close relationship with the Positive Coaching Alliance. And when you do see the little glimpses of him when he talks with his players, I think that he is much more of this new age feel good guy than people might give him credit for. And I've seen it, like when I've been to the finals and watching from afar, like, you know, during the practices, he is sitting down one on one and, you know, tapping him on the knee and giving him encouragement and filling them up with positive energy. It really is something to see. And even when we see on the sidelines, it's, you know, it tends to be in line with, like, you know, positive coaching. So, yeah, you know what I mean? I feel like he probably likes to play that up, but he is probably as a progressive on that end as well.
He is a progressive. We also say, and I think that this is understood, but probably nothing wrong with underlining it, that he's been extraordinarily fortunate himself because of the players that he's had. Part of that is the good fortune. Part of that is just because they're smart. He had a hand in bringing a lot of these guys in, but he has a team that through the years has not had a lot of those guys that run up the tunnel to chase down an opponent and continue a fight. There's a reason that they are team stability, and that's because of the makeup, the personality of the players as well matches the personality of the head coach in terms of the no drama. But let's not mistake that for saying that Greg Popovich is laid back, because he will say things to players. He will get into Tony Parker in a way that will make the paint peel off the walls.
Right.
He will get hostile. He doesn't need many excuses to get into the fast lane with his emotions. So he handles a lot of things well, and there's so much stability in that organization that the Spurs are a model for all of sports on how you want your organization to be. And Popovich is a huge, huge part of that. But he will tear guys up if it calls for it.
You know, I'm a big conspiracy guy, and I'm convinced that Greg Popovich was a spy at some point.
I would go with that.
I don't know. He went to Air Force. I was looking up his history to try and do a breakdown of some coaching tree things, and there's like some weird gap where like I couldn't figure out some stuff, and I feel like I don't know. I'm convinced that there was something going on there.
I would give you the official answer, but I'm not sure you have a high enough security clearance. Right now, rather than telling you and then having to kill you, I'm just going to say no comment.
Okay, well let's move on to you wrote an article recently as we wrap up about the new CBA and the Development League and how that's going to expand, and I'm kind of fascinated by that because I feel like it went so under the radar that we should it needs a little bit more daylight on it. So can you give us a quick overview of what that article was about?
Well, it's a real interesting development as we head into negotiations for the next CBA. It's nothing that anybody feels can be fast-tracked and just put in as an amendment or something to the current CBA to start next season, as much as I think that there's a lot of value to get to it right away. I think it's going to be as part of the next deal. But there's a discussion of basically flex contracts, two-way contracts. And that would allow – you would expand, say, two roster spots in the NBA and have both of those spots go to these two-way contracts where if you were a guy that was thinking D-League, do I want to go to Europe because I can get more money but I'd rather stay in the U.S. and play in front of NBA eyes every night, you're one of those guys that's good enough to get a lot of interest for training camp and summer league. And you have a chance – to make the league, but there's just not that much guaranteed money in there. This is a way to keep more talent in the D League, which obviously helps the D League. They're expanding by three more teams next year, but it also helps the NBA. You can get a player and sign him to a two-way contract and still develop him under your own system. And by expanding two more roster spots, that gives you the breathing room to be able to do that. And in its most basic terminology, there would be a minimum salary for this player, even if he gets sent down to the D League. And right now the conversations are about $100,000. Maybe it goes up to $125,000. Maybe it goes down to $85,000 or $90,000. But the discussion is ballpark $100,000. That player would say, I don't need to go to Europe. I would go to the poorhouse if I had to rely on D League money as opposed to that money I could get in Europe. But $100,000, the chance to be playing in front of NBA scouts all the time, closer to my family and friends. Yeah, I would take that. And then if he gets called up to the NBA, anytime he's in the NBA, he's then on their payroll, working on their prorated minimums. But he would always have that safety net that even if he gets sent back down, he knows that the least he will make that season is $100,000. Now, it's not going to be for everybody. Again, it's going to be only for two players per NBA team, and they don't even have to use them. So at most, we're talking about 60 players. But it's certainly, if you were to look at, even if you say they're only going to, it's only going to go with 45 or 50 players, that's something that still will benefit the D League. The competition there will be better. It will help the NBA because they'll be able to develop a player over the long term. It's not just let's bring this guy up for 10 days and see what he's got. They can bring this guy back and forth. And it's only going to be those two-way players, those flex players. The same rules will apply for the people who are there with NBA contracts. Right now, when you see a first-round pick, for example, get sent down, they don't go on the D-League pay scale when they're down there. They've got their NBA contract.
Sure.
They've got the same money. So this is only in limited cases, but they feel like if it gets up to 60 players, even if it gets to 45 players, it's something that could make a real positive difference. It seems to be a win-win because you're going to the union and saying we want to give out 60 more guaranteed contracts. It's not full NBA money, but it's guaranteed, again, ballpark $100,000 is something that the union, I think, would have to say, yeah, that works for us as well.
Well, you know what I'm hoping for in a way is that this is a precursor towards maybe finally getting one-and-dones out of college and maybe into the D-League instead, so we don't need to have this kind of sham of, you know, college being this place, you know, a minor league for the NBA. Do you feel like there's any connection to that as they move along and this thing continues to do well?
No, because on that scenario, the players still would not be getting drafted. And the rule would still apply that it has to be, again, until the next CBA, and who knows if this will change. But under the current rules, U.S. players, you have to be a year past your high school graduating class.
Oh, to play the D-League too?
No, to join the NBA. So you can't sign that NBA contract. You can join the D-League as strictly a D-League player out of high school, but you can't sign that two-way contract. You cannot have an NBA, any kind of NBA contract, again, for U.S. players a year after your high school graduating class has graduated.
Right, okay.
I think that there's a conversation to be had on your point of whether the one and done works and the age limits, and we could do an entire show on that. But in this case, no, that's not something that factors in.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I just, whenever I start seeing things with D-League and like maybe the idea of increasing spots and then maybe getting to 30 teams, so each NBA team has their own affiliate directly, and that would sort of kick in a minor league system, and all of a sudden, okay, great, because, you know, again, what we're seeing here, you know, and I think Ben Simmons is a great example of this, is that it's like they're not going to college to go to college. They're not taking advantage of what should be a pretty nice benefit of a scholarship and get an education. And nor should they have to do that, but that's sort of how it's set up. So I get excited whenever I hear anything about the D-League and like more focus on that, because that seems to me what we're inching towards.
Makes sense. I agree with some of that. I think that there's a good debate to be had on other points. And again, not to get too far down the road, because it's hours of conversation just on the, just on the age limit rule and the one and done and those aspects. But certainly, if you don't feel like you belong in college, and if you're just going to be there taking up somebody else's spot, whether it's a scholarship or a seat in the classroom, then you have the option not only of playing in Europe after high school rather than going to college. You can go right to the D-League. You absolutely can. You're right about that. A lot of people don't realize that, and not enough people take advantage of that opportunity. You can play professional basketball straight out of high school. You just can't have an NBA, any kind of NBA contract, whether it's the two-way or the straight NBA contract, until 1 year later.
Right. Well, we'll have to have
you can go into the D-League out of high school, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know what? If you look at it this way, people say, it's $25,000. It's not a lot of money, but it's $25,000 more than you get going to college, and you don't have to get up at 8 a.m. for classes or have that kind of thing. So let's save that one for another podcast, and then we'll have to have a podcast about talking about when you started, because I'm kind of curious to hear at some point about the history of when you were starting out in 1988 and what that was like covering the NBA. So let's promise me you'll come back and we'll do another one.
Absolutely. I look forward to that.
You got it. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We had just a terrific conversation, and we'll do it again for sure. And don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel. We're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Scott?
100%.